The charming lady you're going to hear from next was an active member of the first group that I ever attended in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I've known her from the first day of my sobriety, and I sort of saw her from afar. I was a quaking, shaking, but sincere newcomer. And she was pretty well established in this group, had a lot of juice going for her, charming, lovely, and I used to look at her across the room. And then through the years, it's been my pleasure, once in a while I'd flip around the tube and I would catch Ginny in a role in some film, and it just brought me back to that first group so long ago. It was the original Pacific group, which has since moved and enlarged. We used to meet in a little white house, and I could feel the fear and trepidation as I would approach that door. Used to meet then every Tuesday night, I guess, and I remember Jenny from those days and the whole crowd. You don't know how delighted I am to be able to welcome to Omaha, Nebraska, Jenny from Los Angeles, California.
That sounds terrific. My name is Ginny Gates, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. You sound like my home group. Yes, nice. I'm delighted to be here. I don't know why there have been tears coming out of my eyes all morning. I don't know what it is. The smoke. Well, now that you mention smoking. I hate it when it's in a room, too. But listen, I can't give up everything. I love what you do here, too, Ron. I'll do it, too. Through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsors, and people like you. I know God's willing, on August 21st of this month, I will celebrate my 18th sober year in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a long time between drinks, I'll tell you. It's lovely here. I don't know why I thought Nebraska was going to be sort of beige colored. I guess, you know, I don't know, the Midwest, you know, but it's green. It's green, green, and lakes, and it's beautiful, and I'm really happy to be here. I hope maybe this afternoon, maybe I can hitch a ride with somebody for an hour and drive around town and take a look at it. Okay. And I ride one. It's a very lively group. I've been totally blank and teary since I walked into this room. I guess because of being at a conference and being away from home reminds me of conferences past and people I've known in Alcoholics Anonymous who've been very important to me. I see Joe sitting in the front row, and one of his best friends and my best friend used to do a lot of speaking. Eddie Regan. Some of you may have heard him. And I think I learned more from that man about love and self-acceptance and self-worth than I ever would have gotten on my own. And somehow he's kind of here, so give him credit. We are here doing what we're supposed to do. On August 21st, I got to go back and tell you, I'll just take you on the trip with me as best I can. On August 21st, 1963, I woke up. I came to. much as I had other mornings. It's not that I had a hangover. It's just that what I did when I woke up in the morning is I went to the refrigerator, I opened it, I took out a bottle of Lance's wine, and poured a drink, because you can't eat on an empty stomach. Seemed sensible to me. At that time, I lived in a lovely home in West Hollywood. I had a new car, and I had a maid, and I had everything seemingly going for me. I also had a fiancé who paid for all of that stuff. Actually, I had two, one for fun. And that's the way it was. My main job in those days was keeping two separate sets of books about my expenses. One for him and one for me in the bank, you know. And I woke up that morning, I had a roommate. It was another unemployed actress. And we started off the day. That's the way I started my days. And a couple of hours into the day, I was into a blackout again. Apparently, I telephoned a doctor that I knew, and apparently he came to the house. I don't remember any of this, but the doctor showed up at my house, and I had my gun out again. I was going to shoot off my hand, because it was there. And I didn't give much thought to what I did in those days. I just sort of did, you know, anything like that. I don't know, when I hear people speak from AA podiums and give you a blow-by-blow description of those first years and how they felt as kids and all that, I'm just astonished, you know, and how they reacted, because for the most part, I didn't think about what I did in my life. I really was like a leaf that just blew around in the wind. I was just out there surviving. I was just out there getting by as best I could, and I had no idea why or how. I just did what was in front of me to do today, you know. So that day it was the gun, and the reason I had a gun was for self-protection, I told myself. And I don't know, being a lady alcoholic, I don't know what it was I thought I was protecting, but I did. I was very reasonable. The doctor took a look at me with the gun, and he took me to the hospital, and he admitted me for an emotional crisis. I was drunk. And I stayed in that hospital for 6 or 7 days. Now, those 6 or 7 days in the hospital were just another thing I did to think, you know. It was good that I was in the hospital to get away from them. Them, they who were evil and bad and made me do all that stuff. I used to sit in rooms filled with people who'd be getting drunk or getting high, and I'd look at them and I'd think, they're evil. What am I doing here? You know, I don't belong here. They really are comfortable together, this group, and I'm an outsider in this group, and I don't really belong here. When I got to AA, I found out if you walk like a duck and talk like a duck, chances are you're a duck. But the thing is, I never felt it. No matter what I was involved in, I never felt that I was a part of it. I always felt scared, and I didn't know what I was doing there. I never knew what I was doing there. So I used to do a lot of things to find out what's wrong with me. Not about drinking. Until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it never once occurred to me that I had a drinking problem. I got to tell you, I'm around the clock falling down drunk when I'm drinking. If I'm awake, I'm drinking. If I'm single, I'm drinking. When I'm married, I don't drink. See, I came in with a set of standards which would choke a horse. I had two different lives, you know, black and white, good and bad, married, single. That's the way I did that, you know. And so if I was single, I was drunk, drinking, enjoying my life, being bad, flying around the world or the country, or going to lovely restaurants and dancing on the table with a rose between my teeth and just really having a wonderful time. But I was bad and I knew it, see. I knew that. I had the good grace to feel guilty about it. And when you feel guilty about it, you get to drink some more. See, it's a setup. And that was my bad life. And then there was my good life, and that is that every periodically a knight on a white horse would come along. And they'd find me dancing on the table with a rose between my teeth, and it seemed to me that they'd whisk me off the table and take me out to the stick somewhere to scrub floors, you know. That's the way it seemed to me. And when I got married, then that was a good life. I knew that now you have to be good, and now you don't drink. To drink is to die. To cheat is to die. To do any of it. Good is you're married and you have children and you keep the floors sparkling clean. The children have starched little ribbons and stuff, you know. That's good. I don't know where I got this picture. See, I don't come from a home like that. My mother always worked. My father worked. They were middle-class working people. My mother preferred to work than to stay home, so we always had a housekeeper of some kind in. And, you know, I don't come from a home where the children sparkled and all that happened. I come from a home where they do a lot of drinking, where there's a lot of fighting and yelling and screaming. And I don't know where I got this, but it must have been out of magazines. You know, I'm a product of the movies of the 40s and the 50s. And so that's good, and that's desirable, to keep getting married. Consequently, I said I do six times. Only four different husbands, though. Two of them I went back and got even. Don't get hurt, get even. So I lived my life like that, you know. In my opinion, I went from good to black to white. That's the way I lived my life, I thought. And as an alcoholic. I mean, when I drink, everybody drinks the way I drink. All my friends drink the way I drink. I wouldn't dream of spending time with somebody who didn't drink the way I drink, you know. So when I was in the hospital, it was just like another one of the things I used to do to find out what was wrong with me. Among other things, as I told you, I got married a lot. And then I would be good for as long as I could stand it. And when I couldn't stand it one more minute, I would drink and get out of there, and I would breathe a sigh of relief and go play and be bad again. And, ah, it was wonderful to be bad, right? And the funny thing I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it took me years, and I can't tell you how many years it took me to find it out. What I found out is none of the things I was doing that I got guilty about and punished myself about and drank about was bad. None of them were bad. What's wrong with traveling around? What's wrong with eating in a nice restaurant? What's wrong with any of those things I was doing? I set it up as bad. Nobody else thought there was anything wrong with that. It was always me. And that's the biggest lesson I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that I've always been quite enough for everybody else, but I've never been enough for me. So, what I used to do is go to health farms, get away from them. I remember when I went to a health farm once, years before I got sober. It was the first time anybody ever asked me if I drank. And I was, one of my shticks is I'm honest. It's one of my gimmicks, to be totally honest. And then you can't blackmail me, anything you blackmail me for, I brag about first, see. I lived my whole life in a totally defensive stance. You cannot get anything on me, right? So I thought about it, how much do I drink, you know? I said, yeah, I do, I guess maybe six, seven drinks a day. I mean, that's what it seemed like to me, and I told the doctor that. I mean, that's normal drinking, isn't it? A couple of years later, I was on one of my marriages, and I was pouring a drink, and my husband walked into the kitchen. He said, what are you doing, Jenny? I'm having a drink. He said, well, look at this. And he took this large old-fashioned glass I had, filled with scotch. He took a 1.5-ounce jigger, and he decanted from the big glass into the little glass, which must have had dust in it for as often as I would have used it, you know. And he decanted, and he decanted 7 times. Well, that's at least 10 ounces. Well, it only takes 6 or 7 drinks a day. You know, so it takes about 70 ounces of booze a day, and that's about what I was drinking when I got here, 2 quarts a day. I had the bill from the drugstore to prove it, because you can't get out of the house and go shop yourself, you know. They would just deliver it. My day, it was 5:19 every time they came. That was either a quart of Smirnoff's and a pint of orange juice. You don't want to be tacky. it would just be a quart of JB. You know, the reason I started drinking scotch is because I realized I got a little out of hand sometimes when I drank. So when I was drinking martinis or something that tasted good, I knew that maybe I'd overdo it, so I will drink something I don't like. I don't like scotch. You know, I think it's awful. It's like medicine, you know. So I'll drink it, and then I'll drink more slowly. Never occurred to you to stop drinking. Just, we'll drink scotch. So I started off with the JB tall water, and I came to JB water, and then I came to JB on the rock, and then I ended up with JB water back, you know. And then finally I just had a big magnum on a rocker, and I just walk past and go like this and pull it down. Because, you know, you learn to like it if that's all that's available. So that's the way I drank. You know, I sent out for it and I sat there and drank. I remember when I was about 21, I was working in a car agency, an advertising secretary, and I shared an office with the manager who was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was 5 or 6 years sober. And he used to watch me come in every day, sort of a little shaky and telling him, Matt, you know what happened last night? I didn't remember getting home. Isn't that funny? Couldn't remember getting home. Want to have lunch? And he would take me to lunch and buy me double martinis, because that's what I ate for lunch. And then he would tell me about it. He said, you know, I've been an alcoholic since I was 17 years old. I'd say, do tell, imagine that, sure. He'd tell me stories about, you know, there came a time when I would try to write my name on a check, and my hand would go flying off the page until I took a sip of a drink, and then I could write my name. And I thought, that sounds dramatic. I like that. So, you know, I work as an actress part-time, and so I like the drama of that. I saw I'll Cry Tomorrow, you know, Days of Wine and Roses, and Lost Weekend. I kind of looked forward to it. I would have liked to have been an alcoholic. It would have been dramatic to fall into garbage pails on Skid Row. You know? And then have those derelicts on Skid Row pick me up and take me up to a 50-cent room where I would do anything for a drink. Yes, I liked that. And I was kind of looking forward to that, you know, but it had nothing to do with my life. I wasn't an alcoholic. And so he'd tell me these stories, and I'd listen to them. And then there came a time that I went to sign my name to a check, and my hand flew off the page. And I liked it. I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? Here, let's try this. Oh, it works. Okay. It works. And I could sign my name. And so I learned it. You know, that's when I learned about when you get up in the morning, you drink. You drink. And then the day is fine. Say good morning, and then you say goodbye Thursday, and so anyway, on August 21st, I went to the hospital, the way I'd gone to health farms to see what was wrong with me, the way I got married and divorced, you know, what was wrong with me, the way I went through psychoanalysis for 2 years, 3 hours a week for 2 years, writhing on the couch with the psychoanalyst, trying to seduce him. You know, I figured if I didn't realize it. Now, anything I know about myself, I learned here. When I came here, I didn't know anything about me. Didn't learn anything in psychoanalysis, in group therapy, at the health farms, in Eastern and Western religions, in Buddhism, in unity, and please. All of those things may have kept me alive until I got here, but I didn't learn anything about me. But now I know that I writhed on the couch for those 2 years thinking if I can seduce him, then I won't have to learn anything about me. It's getting a little too close for comfort. Let's do something I know how to do. Finally, he was not seducible. He wouldn't have any. So being a good alcoholic, I didn't pay him. I see there are a few other psychiatry bills outstanding. Actually, you know what happened on that? When I was about 5 or 6 years sober, that psychiatrist found me. Now it's 15 years later or something, you know. He found me. Now, I had cooperated with him in serving papers on my ex-husband. My ex-husband should have paid that, you know. And I had cooperated, you know, being a good wife, I'd set my husband up to meet me for coffee in a restaurant so he could be served. charming. He was never supposed to bother me again, but the psychiatrist did come after me. Yeah, I was about 6 years sober. At the time, I was married to a lawyer. Well, what happened is that after 6 years of sobriety, the fact was that there was a large outstanding bill. Now, my ex-husband, who should have paid the bill, didn't have to pay the bill because he's not an alcoholic and his life didn't depend on it. And so with me, it suddenly became unfinished business again. I thought I'd made all my amends and here was another one. So I said, okay, I can't have this hanging over my head, so we're going to have to do something about this. So we actually took care of that analyst bill that many years later. The truth about that is also that my husband, being a lawyer, he settled for 10 cents on a dollar, and he was lucky to get it. But we settled it, you know, we closed that door. So I tried everything to find out what was wrong with me. There's something lacking in me. Why am I not enough for me? My banner in life was, why am I not enough? Why do I feel so inadequate? Why do I feel as though somehow I'm conning you into loving me and accepting me, but I don't fit here. I never fit here. You know, I found out in AA where that comes from. In my case, I have a perfectly good reason for feeling inadequate. I come from an Italian-Venezuelan household. They were first generation in this country. And when they got off the boat and looked around, it seemed to them that the blondes had everything, you know. It seemed to them that the thing to be was blonde, blue-eyed, WASP. You know, that was the thing to be. And so from my earliest memory, the thing they told my sister and I was that the thing we had to do was marry a tall blonde with blue eyes and a straight nose and lighten the race. Well, that's a hell of a goal, you know. Lighten the race. And what I realized sober is that if that's what you teach a child, then every time they walk past a mirror, what they get is curly black hair, a hook nose, which I say I took care of as soon as I had the money, dark skin, you know, just not enough, not enough, not enough. So every time I walk past the mirror, that's what I got, not enough. The trouble with that is that other people go through that as children, and when they grow up, they let go of all that stuff. As an alcoholic, my disease is I couldn't let go of any of that stuff. That was the banner I carried, and that was the excuse I used all my life to do whatever I had to do. And I just felt always not. I didn't like being called Blackie. I didn't like having kinky hair. I didn't like anything about me. And I did the best I could to marry all the blondes with blue eyes I could, to appease them. My children, thank God, none of them came out blonde with blue eyes. They were all green-eyed and brown-haired, and I'm delighted. You know, that's fine, but how come it stayed with me and doesn't stay with other people? That's my disease. When I was in junior high school, part of my disease of feeling inadequate and coming from behind, you know, what I found out here is that if you're coming from that far behind, where you're never fit and you're never enough for yourself, that's what the common denominator I found here, too, at least among the women I work with, is total lack of self-worth and self-esteem. And I can't believe it, because I can look at them, and I see that they are just beautiful. They are giving, they are loving, they have made all these efforts to change their lives, and they're sharing their lives, and they're creative. Some of the ladies I work with are, you know, wonderful photographers and artists and all of this stuff. And they give a lot, and they're lovely, and they beat themselves to death because they're not enough. And I think, my God, for whom are you not enough? And so I see it in them, and I learned it about me. If it applies to them, it applies to me. But, you know, it started in junior high school, not being enough. I remember the school dances. And at the school dances, I was the second best dancer in the school. I studied dancing and singing as a child. I was the second best dancer in the school. Well, that's enough to commit suicide over. Because there was another girl who was the first best dancer in the school. And therefore, she got the guy to dance with who was the first best dancer in the school. And never mind that there were 500 other boys that I could dance with, I couldn't stand not getting to dance with him. So what I chose to do with that, being the way I am, is I found the ones who'd go out and lie about their age and buy wine. And I started drinking. And that kind of made it all okay. Then I didn't have to feel humiliated that I wasn't number one. So I learned that if you're coming from that far behind, you have to please God, be treated extra special number one, just to feel even, not to feel better than, just to get even. I was coming from behind, couldn't get even. So I learned how to drink. And my drinking was always different. Always different. My drinking when I lived in South America for a year when I was about 16 there. And there I was a woman. You know, it's not like you're 16, you were a kid. There I was a woman and allowed to do things. And even with permission to do things, I noticed that they'd pour me a drink and I would take that drink and hide it in the bookcase. I'd hide it in the bookcase and I'd go back for a drink. And then I would drink that one publicly and kill that one. And, you know, I'd keep that game going, you know, refilling and refurbishing so that I would appear to be drinking the way they drank, but I'd really have one going from the time I was 15 or 16 years old. I mean, I just drank. That's what I did. That's what alcoholics do. I didn't know it. Just trying to be able to breathe. My friend Eddie taught me that the main thing we have to do here is just keep breathing. Keep breathing, and finally it'll all work out. Anyway, we'll go back to how and when I got here. You get here as just a basket case the way I was, not knowing what was wrong with me, what was going on in my life. The only thing I knew was I wasn't an alcoholic. That's all I knew. A friend of mine had come to AA a few months before, and God knows she needed it. If I'd ever drank the way she drank, I would have gone too. You've got to keep those people around who do worse than we do, so you can feel superior to somebody, please God. And the doctor kept me there for 6 or 7 days, and then I went home, and I didn't drink that day, which is a miracle, because I drank. And I woke up the next morning, and there was about a 12-inch tall red rat on my bed. And I knew it wasn't there. You know, I'd seen those movies. I knew it wasn't there. And I thought that's some kind of hallucination, you know. And maybe somebody else would have gotten frightened if they'd seen that rat on the bed. Didn't bother me at all. Just great to finally, at long last, I'm going to get to check out. I'm going to get to flip out. Because what I wanted to be when I grew up was catatonic. Anyway. That's all I want. I'm tired of thinking. I'm tired of trying to figure it out. And here it comes. I'm going to check out. And I'm going to go to a nice little... I'm going to go to a nice little padded cell somewhere, and there's going to be that chicken wire on the window, and I'm going to sit there like Peggy Lee in that movie many years ago, singing little songs, and they'll take away all sharp objects and razor blades and belts, and I'll just forget it. I don't want to think anymore. I liked that thought. Unfortunately, when I got sober, I told that story about... the way I felt about that room. As a matter of fact, the story ended with, and the doctors will come by and look in at this sweet, loving child who wouldn't hurt a fly, and they'll say, "That's Ginny. She hasn't spoken in 3 years, you know." And I thought, that's nice. That's dramatic. And when I told that story in AA, someone said to me, "That's all good and well, Camille, you know. That's a lovely story, but in fact, you apparently haven't done any time in an institution like that." So the way that story really plays out is you're sitting there, and you haven't spoken in 3 years, and who really comes by is a nurse and an orderly. And they look in at you, and since you haven't spoken, you probably didn't tell anyone. And I said, "Yes." And they said, "Probably what they say is, 'Oh, Christ, Ginny's crapped in her pants again.'" And the other said, "Well, she'll just have to sit in it because I'm tired of cleaning up after her." And they said, "Did that ever occur to you?" I said, "No, never. Never occurred to me that that's the way real life would go. I want to really go out like Camille, you know. Cough a few times and keel over, you know." I had a lot of fantasies like that when I was drinking. About what I used to say that the reason I didn't get along in this world, I was born in the wrong generation. The wrong century is where I was born. I really am much more comfortable in another century, I'm sure, where elevators don't tell me to move to the rear. That bothers me, that they know I'm in there, you know? I don't like that. And that computers do all these things, and that my Social Security, I get a little paranoid about all that, that they know everything about me. I felt I would have functioned well in the court of Louis XIV. 15, like Marie Antoinette, let them eat cake. And then what I used to say is, really where I would have been very comfortable would have been in a harem, in the days of sultans and harems, you know. Because when I worked in films in those years, I did that a lot. I had long black hair and I wore those pantaloons and I was always that person. And I thought, yeah, there, I'd know how to be in a harem with a bunch of women. And, of course, I would be the sultan's favorite, naturally. And I could function there. My husband suggested to me once, he said, "Did this ever occur to you?" He said, "Supposing you had been born in the time of sultans and harems and favorites and all that stuff." He said, "All things being equal, did it ever occur to you that there's a very good possibility that you might have been out in the field picking beans?" He said, "No, that never occurred to me." And I want to tell you something after almost 18 years of sobriety. I would have been the Sultan's favorite. Boy, it takes us a long time to find out who we are, you know? A long, long time. When I came to AA at the end of that day with the rat on the bed and the whole room becoming a fishing vessel, because I used to fish and I loved it, but not in my living room. And so I called this girlfriend of mine who'd gone to AA, and she took me to a meeting, and she took me to that Pacific group on a Tuesday night. And I didn't hear anything. I mean, and I let me tell you how I went to the meeting. I went to the meeting with my hair in rollers and no makeup. It was just AA. Who's going to be there? You know? I wore, like, sandals. My concession to the possibility that there might have been someone in the room who might have been interesting to this materialistic phony who was coming to this first meeting was I wore hand-tailored slacks from Israel. In case there was somebody else with a little class in the room who knew well-seeming when they saw it, that he and I, of course it would have been a he, that he and I would find each other across the crowded floor and maybe go out and have a drink after the meeting. I don't know. That was my concession to that anything important could be happening here. And the rest of it was very casual, and I didn't hear anything at that meeting. I know now the reason is that when I went into that hospital, though they took away the alcohol and I had no withdrawal, the reason I had no withdrawal was because they put me on pills, whatever the popular tranquilizer was then, you know. So I just withdrawn. They just changed my mode of transportation, you know. Doesn't matter what kind of shoes you're wearing if you're running. So I used alcohol to round the edges of reality. They took it away. They gave me something else. I was still out to lunch, you know. So I didn't hear that anything at that first meeting. So at the end of the meeting, this girl and I were standing there, and three men asked us if we'd like to have coffee. Well, this is God working in my life always and immediately, because I know now that if it had been, I believe now that if it had been lovely women saying, would you like to go have coffee, I believe I would have been very intimidated, very defensive, jealous. All the things I accused other women of being, I would have been. That's how I judged other women, by the yardstick of me. I'm the only one I knew, you know. So whatever I was thinking other women were in those days was what I was. I didn't like women. They gossiped and they were petty. I had a whole list of things that women were. And now I love women. I just love women. Because I love me, finally. Finally. If you're new in this room, I want to guarantee you this. It took me years in this program, because I'm a slow learner, to finally come to the place where I love me, and I love me just the way I am. So if you don't have it yet, hold on, it's coming. I promise you. So what God did for me that night is he gave me these three men, and they invited us out for coffee so I could go play whatever game I'd been playing for the first 29 years of my life, you know. We went out for coffee. Funny, I just realized recently that the three men, one was a lawyer, one was a stockbroker, and the other one was a public relations man. Our first three members, our founders, were a lawyer, a stockbroker, and a doctor. And I just realized that recently, just one off. But I went out with these three men, and I was in between marriages, you must remember. I had been single for 8 months. Looking bad, you know, a little puffy, time to get married again. I tended to listen to men. I wasn't defensive with them. And I could run my tape that I didn't even know existed. We got to this coffee shop and they asked me to tell my life story, and I told the version I'd been telling of it. I told the glamorous jet set version, the travel, the money, property, and prestige. Never was ever mine. I never had two beans to rub together. There was always a man who had that, you know. But at least I had the use of it, which is all that really matters, I found out. What difference does it make if it's a pink slip or a white slip if you're driving it, you know? I got real simple in AA. I got real simple. They asked me to tell my story, and I told that version of it. And when I was finished, one of those men, a man by the name of Clancy I, said, listen, the thing you have to do is go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the first year of your sobriety. And I said to him, oh, just a moment. You don't understand. I'm a very busy girl. I have a lot of irons in the fire. I'm an actress, you know. I have places to go and people to see. I can't give myself to this thing you have here, however nice it may be. And I have other plans. You say, well, what other plans do you have? I said, well, for instance, I'm leaving for Chicago next week. See, the truth was that I had one of my fiancés who paid for that house, maid, and car, and all of that. What he did for a living was he carried a black bag filled with money for a large union, transported these funds, and when your fiancé says, we're going to Chicago next week in that league, you go to Chicago next week. And so that's the kind of freedom I really had when I got here. So I had to go to Chicago next week. I still haven't made it to Chicago, Emmett. And Clancy said to me, listen, in your best judgment, the thing you have to do is go to Chicago next week. However, your best judgment put you into the hospital last week. Your best judgment has had you married and divorced every 2 years of your life. Your best judgment has had you through psychotherapy, group therapy, and psychoanalysis. Your best judgment has had you in and out of Eastern and Western religions. Your best judgment has had you to health farms and hospitals and jails. Would you consider the possibility that your best judgment is not valid? You know, that in that's such a simple throwaway line. And each year that I'm sober, it is a more incredible, it is incredible, that line, because that sentence changed my life. In your best judgment, the thing you have to go to do is go to Chicago. Your best judgment did this. Would you consider the possibility that your best judgment is not valid? It changed my life on the spot. Because what happened is it was like drowning and going down for the third time. It was like my whole life rolled into an instant. Works. Is that why my judgment is no good? My values are messed up. My standards. I don't know what'll make me happy, and I don't know what. Is that why nothing lasts? And it was just instant. I just got a replay, an instant replay. And I said to him, "Yeah, I'll consider that possibility. What do I have to do?" And he said, "Why don't you just turn your head off and let us do your thinking for you for a while?" And I said, okay. See, that's what I wanted anyway. I wanted that. I told you that. I wanted to flip out. I wanted to be catatonic. And my good fortune was that I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that the only man I know of who would presume to take over your thinking and your life for you did it. He had no right to do that. See? He had absolutely no right to say that or do that or tell me what to do, but he literally saved my life by doing it, by guaranteeing me that I'd be all right. I'd be all right if I did what he told me to do, and I did it. And the first thing he said, one of the first things he said was, you have to get rid of that fiancé. And I said, well, wait a minute, you don't understand. See, I have this big house and a maid and a car, and he pays for all that. And I wouldn't be able to do that. Why do I have to get rid of the fiancé? He said, because he's a married man. And I said, what does that have to do with AA? Actually, 18 years later, I wonder what that had to do with AA. But, see, I wanted... It wasn't that I wanted what you had. Because I didn't know what you had. It was a brand new ball game. I'd never considered that I was an alcoholic. I'd never thought about what I needed in my life. I didn't know what you had. All I knew is I didn't want any more of what I had. I couldn't stand another minute of what I had. I was going crazy. So I was just willing to do whatever you told me to do. I also wanted to be the golden girl. I remember that. All of this happened in my first few days of sobriety. I looked around the room. They pointed out a lady who was just leaving town the week I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, Marion F. and she was kind of the female Chuck Chamberlain of our area. And they said to me about Marion, that lady is so spiritual, she lights up the corner where she stands. And I said, an alcoholic woman lights up corners? Well, move over, Marion, because I'm here. So I would have done anything to get your approval. I wanted to be that person. So I would have done anything. So I wanted to be the best AA baby that ever was. You know, people used to say, you're growing so quickly, we can watch you grow. And I'd straighten up, grow before their very eyes. I needed that approval. I just had never had so much approval and acceptance, you know. All I had to do was stay sober. Thank God they told me that every day that I didn't drink, I was working up to my full potential, and I was a success if I didn't drink that day. Well, God, when you know, that was easy compared to all the other things I thought I had to be in this world that were unattainable, you know. So just, I was a success every day. And I said, I will do this. I will never drink again. I want this. I'll never drink again. They told me, you can't never drink again. They said, there's some conditions attached to not drinking again. I said, well, like what? They said, well, there's some changes. You have to do some changing in order not to drink again. I said, well, what do I have to change? And they said, about you, everything has to change in front of me, along with all the other things I would put in front of it. So I made a commitment at that time to Alcoholics Anonymous. My commitment was and is, I'm willing to do anything I have to do to change in order that I don't have to drink again. I am willing to do anything I have to do to change in order that I never have to drink again. And it has worked for me. My first years of sobriety were a marshmallow. They really were a marshmallow. They told me not to get emotionally involved, so I got pregnant instead. The way it was. So it was just charming for one's image. I mean, if you're really planning to light up corners, you really shouldn't pick up with a loser on the program, you being a newcomer, and walk around pregnant and unmarried. It doesn't get it. I didn't know what to do about that, except I had an 11-year-old child, and I'd been told I'd never have another one as a result of an accident I had while carrying her. And so to me, it was a miracle that I was pregnant. And I figured God didn't take me this far to drop me on my head here, you know, that there was a reason for this. So I talked to my sponsor, and he talked to his sponsor. And actually, what Chuck did was he drew little circles and big circles. Did Chuck ever draw those for you? That's his answer to everything. This little circle is you. This big circle is God's will. Now, your whole chore in life is to take this little circle and keep it inside that big circle. That's all you have to do. And then it doesn't matter what decisions you make. It doesn't matter. It'll all be okay. It'll all work out. However, if you take that little circle out of the big circle, well, it also doesn't matter what choices or decisions you make in your life. It'll all turn to crap because it's not in the big circle. So armed with that kind of information, we just proceeded to get married because it seemed the thing to do, you know. And as a result of it, I had a baby boy. And the wonder of that is that the world of men changed in the instant I saw my son. And the world of men needed changing. My attitude about men needed changing. And when I saw that little boy, it was just, I see, they're just like little girls. That's all. It's all the same. All we do is just get bigger, you know, and things around mold us and, you know, but we're all God's kids. We're all God's kids. And so I needed changing about men. The years were a marshmallow because I had that child. I was totally protected. I had Don on one side, my husband, and Clancy as a sponsor, and the Pacific group as a family, and my baby boy, my daughter was with me. I was very active in Alcoholics Anonymous. They taught me never to say no to anything, and I never said no. I still haven't said no to an AA request. I did learn how to say no to things that were not AA connected, thank God. Boy, I'll tell you, my lady sponsor taught me about that once. It's a big step. I had said no to somebody who was really kind of demanding too much of me, and I felt guilty when I said no. You know, why did I feel guilty? And my lady sponsor finally got through to me and said, "You have to learn something, Ginny. That if you haven't learned to say no, then you've never really said yes." And at that moment, I realized that I had no priorities in my life. I mean, the one priority I had was sobriety. I always had that from my first day in Alcoholics Anonymous. But the rest of it, I would spend as much time with a total stranger as I spend with my son. I had no way to judge that. It was still so important to me that everybody loved me. You know, that I would just say yes, 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 and I would just feel as though I was dissipating and falling apart and there's going to be nothing left to me. And my sponsor taught me that I had to get some priorities in my life, find out what was most important, and learn to say no. And I did learn to do that, for the most part. So it was a marshmallow with a lot of AA activity and many, many babies in AA, and our house was always filled with AA people, and it was terrific for many years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then it wasn't. And that's probably the... Probably, you know, I was thinking this morning, what is your message? What do you have to share? You know, and, well, you know, what I have to share is that if we're members of this fellowship, no matter what happens, we don't have to drink ever again. What I found out is that if you don't take that first drink, you can do almost everything else. They told me that, by the way. They told me that everything I'd ever done drinking, I would do sober. And I thought, you don't know some of the things I've done. You know, I'm not going to do them sober. Well, I'm here to tell you that I have done everything sober that I ever did drinking. And I did it sober. They told me I was taking myself on this trip. They told me that all my life, whenever things got rough, I just avoided it, denied it, drank it, got past it. They said, this time you go through it. This time you go through it and learn. I mean, it's so many simple... I don't know how I lived before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous without any of the things I learned here. When Don was talking last night about his attitude, the attitude, learning to see and hear, you know, I mean, I had the same thing. Most of the people I know in AA have that same thing. And how I lived with, I don't know. I remember once when I was newly sober in this program that a woman who had never worked in her life, I went to work, you know, I did get out of that house. I did get rid of the fiancé, and I did go to work. Took a small apartment. They told me it didn't matter what I had on the outside. What mattered was what it felt like on the inside. And thank God I believed it. I moved into an $89 a month little apartment and went to work for $4.75 a month in 1963. I had forgotten that I was a qualified secretary, that I could do all that stuff, and that's what I did. I had to work every day. And a woman who was older than I got a job. She didn't know how to do anything, and she was something of a bore, this woman. And she got up on a podium one night, apropos of that kind of hearing and seeing, and she was so pleased because as a result of mentioning it at an AA meeting, she'd gotten a job doing something in an office for which she was totally unqualified, and she was going to make $4.75 a month. And you know, my reaction to that was I hated her. I hated her. How can I pay her $4.75 a month and she doesn't know how to do anything, and that's what I make is $4.75 a month, and I'm so qualified? And I thought, where does this reaction come from? Other people are clapping and happy for her. And I had to look at that, and I had to take an inventory on that. You know, it was all those little lessons I had to learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I found out about that is it had to do with me. If she can make $4.75, that demeans me. I'm worth less. I'm not, what I'm worth is nothing. If that nothing can make that, right? And I said to myself, God, Ginny, what difference does it make? Why aren't you happy? But what she earns has nothing to do with you. You are you, and you're God's kid, and you stand here, and every man's wealth enhances you. It doesn't diminish you. But I thought if you had more than I had, it diminished me. Because I'm the earth, and you're all satellites, and you only exist insofar as you relate to me. And that's the way I was when I got here. And I had to turn my eyes around. That's what they told me to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. Notice, please, that there are people out there in the world. Notice that they have lives, and notice that they have histories and families and stuff. I didn't know any of that stuff. You only existed in relationship to me. If you had a bad time, it made me look better. If you had a wonderful time, I thought, how do you live? I don't know how any of us live with that kind of perception in the world. I finally got it that her good fortune was our good fortune, was my good fortune. If good things can happen to you, they can happen to me. I finally got that. That one had nothing to do with the other, didn't take away from, that it was an infinite pie, that there were not just 8 slices in the pie, and if you got one, that was less for me. The world and everything in it is infinite and is enough for everybody. Your getting it doesn't take it away from me, thank God. Because now it's my pleasure, I'm glad. You tell me something good happened to you, I think, great, that means there's more of it out there for all of us, you know. But I didn't know that when I got here. I didn't know it. I thought there was an end, a box, about that box. After many years of sobriety and having it good and things working out well, then they weren't good. Then I spent some years suddenly with a series of back aches and back ailments that I couldn't explain. And I would not be able to go to bed with back pain. And I would run to the doctors and have all kinds of tests, and they'd find nothing wrong with me. And I was in pain. And we'd get right to the point where they would start to write a prescription for phenobarbital for the pain. And at that point, it would get my attention. I'd say, no, I'm an alcoholic. I don't take anything like that. If aspirin doesn't get it, it doesn't get got. That's what they taught me here. If aspirin doesn't get it, it doesn't get got. So I'd walk away and wonder if I was setting myself up to get to a prescription, to get to something, to get to some relief from the pain. And then I'd go about my business until I was back in my bed again. And I lay there, and, you know, I had had some metaphysical training, and I was on to myself somewhat after years of inventories and looking at me. And I lay in that bed, and I thought, it's something you don't want to look at, you don't want to deal with, and you're just going to lie here and not deal with it, aren't you? You don't want to see what it is that's bothering you. And I couldn't get out of that bed for a long time. Where did that go? I had to take an inventory some years back. I decided that what was wrong in my marriage was that I wasn't a good enough housewife, that I didn't cook dinners on time, and I didn't keep the house sparkling clean, and I had a whole thing. I didn't realize what I was saying. I didn't realize what I was setting myself up for. And I decided to become good again in my marriage, and went to my sponsor and discussed it. My sponsor agreed that I should do all these things, and I came home and discussed it with my husband, and my husband said, wow, why are you going to do all these things? And I said, well, I think it's I should get good and change and do all these things. And he said, well, I want to do, but I don't know why you're doing that. I said, well, don't you think that's wonderful that I'm going to cook dinners and polish the floors and stay home more than... He said, I not only don't think it's wonderful, I think you're sabotaging yourself again. And I said, well, don't you want me to be all these things? He said, no. He said, you're fine with me the way you are. And I said, well, if you don't want me to be this way, and I don't want me to be this way, who wants me to be this way? For whom am I not enough, you know? And I had to sit down again. You know, when I got sober, they told me that learning about myself was going to be like peeling an onion. That it's all the same onion, and you just get closer to the core. That's all. It's all the same onion. Now, the truth is that everything I ever learned about myself in the later years of sobriety, I learned in the first couple of years of sobriety. I had all the information available to me in the first couple of years through the program, through the steps, and through working with people. And I have to keep learning the same lessons over and over and over, and I get closer to the core every time I do it, to the truth of what's going on with me, you know. And here I was again, writing an inventory, and that was probably the most important inventory I ever had to take, because I had to ask myself once again, for whom are you not enough? Who doesn't think you're enough? And I asked myself, gee, Jenny, why is it that if they, the people out there, make a mistake, make a fool of themselves, look bad, don't accomplish, don't achieve, fall on their face, whatever it is human beings do, why is it it's quite all right if they do that? Because it's people. That's what people do. People do all these things. Why is it, if I do it, if I look bad, if I make a mistake, if I make a fool of myself, why is that intolerable? It was intolerable for me to be just another human being. Why do I go from either being warm and wonderful and perfect to evil and malevolent? What is that? You know, why do I do that to myself? For whom am I not enough? And I wondered if this is what I had done always, you know, in each marriage, in everything I'd ever attempted. I never finished anything in my life. I ran away from everything. And I wondered if this is what I was doing again, setting it up. I always said they took me off the table where I was dancing with a rose between my teeth, and they took me out to Pacoima to scrub floors, you know. And what I realized in this inventory is nobody ever asked me to get off the table. Nobody ever thought there was anything wrong with me. I'm the only one who thought that. And I said, was this, I got it, you know, I finally got it, that this is my MO, that this is what I do in all areas of my life always, drinking and sober, that I create an environment, I create it, an environment in which I can't exist, and then I get to run away from what I've created, that I build the jail, that I build the prison, that I restrict me, that I've got the key, and I could let myself out. Only I say, you're doing it. I thought, you know why? Because if you do it, I get to blame you, and I get to leave you. If I can find enough things in AA, I need AA meetings, but they don't let me go to the movies on Wednesday night. And they don't let me go to ball games. Or they don't let me sleep with whomever I feel like sleeping with. Or they don't let... If I can find enough things that AA doesn't allow me to do, I get to leave AA. I want to tell you, especially if you knew, AA doesn't care what you do at all. Do anything you want to do. The only thing you don't do is you don't drink. That's all. There's no reasons for leaving AA. AA doesn't care what you do. So I had done this in each of my marriages, and I had done this in my career, and I had done this everywhere. I built the prison and blamed you for it. I don't know what the payoff was on that. I asked myself, why would I do that? If anybody else did that for me, I'd kill them. Why would I do it to me? Well, while I'm doing it, I get to be a martyr and noble and wonderful. Aren't I wonderful? Look what I'm doing for you. And then I get to leave you, and I get that wonderful relief. Really, of what I got to do often was I get to go and drink again. It's what I get to do. I found out that every minute of my life, I was doing exactly what I wanted to do, no matter what I said I wanted to do. And I didn't like that discovery at all, because what it did is it made me responsible for my life. I really would rather The baby in me would rather spend my life blaming you and him and her and them for the conditions of my life. I really don't want to be responsible, you know. And I finally realized I'm responsible for every moment of my life. I'm always doing what I want to do. I had spent my life saying that I'd love to live at the beach, but I can't live at the beach because it's not convenient to Don's work. So therefore, I didn't live at the beach. By the way, I now live at the beach. I want you to, the way you find out what people want to do is by observing what they do. That's what they want to do, no matter what they say they want to do. I'd always wanted, I learned how to stop saying but in my life. That I had a lot of things in my life that I wanted to do, but I couldn't because. And everything that followed the but was a lie. It was a lie. It was the way I sabotaged myself, restricted myself, and made myself miserable and a martyr. That everything that followed the but was a lie. So what I said is, from now on, you're not going to say but anymore. You want to do something, you better be doing it, because nobody's keeping you from doing it, except you. So one of the things I'd always wanted to do was, I'd always wanted to go to Europe. But I couldn't go to Europe because my husband didn't want to go to Europe. And at that point it occurred to me that I was 44 years old, that I had the money, and I probably could make it to Europe myself. Well, that's a new thought, isn't it? I did wait until there was an AA convention going on in Paris. I wasn't that daring. And I went on my own. I went to Paris to an AA convention some years ago. And I want to describe to you who went to the convention. Who went to the convention was a middle-aged, tired, back ailment-ridden, psychosomatic, has-been, suburban housewife, bore, who went. Boring lady went to Paris. Before one last fling before you die. That's the way it felt, you know. That's the way it felt. I got to Paris and I realized that everything I thought about myself was a lie. Within 2 or 3 hours, I found that I felt like me. Within 2 or 3 hours. And I couldn't figure out what was happening. Now I know what happened. All I knew was I was totally free, totally well, Totally joyous. I was happy and joyous, and my God, I felt as though I was home. I felt the way I felt when I came to AA. I'm home. What it was, I was in a Latin country. I was in a Latin country meeting Italians and Spaniards and French people and Greek. I was meeting people who were like me, and they talked with their hands, and they embraced easily. And they were outgoing, like me, and I hadn't realized it until then, that since I had thought that it wasn't all right to be like that, to be Latin, I was masquerading as a WASP. I'd been masquerading in suburbia as the lawyer's wife, I'd been moderating my voice and trying to be what I wasn't for all those years sober. And the point I want to make about that is, no one told me to do it. No one asked me to do that. I'm the only one for whom I wasn't enough. I did that to me. And all of a sudden, everybody was like me. I grew up eating coffee and Kaiser rolls for breakfast. I lived over a bakery in New York, and I loved dunking Kaiser rolls and coffee. And I didn't like leafy green vegetables and salads and good stuff. You know, I don't like all that stuff. That, you know, when you go to school and they have the basic good chart about what you're supposed to eat, I don't know from that. I like spaghetti, you know. I like stuff. Food, you know. All of a sudden I was in Paris and they were eating coffee and rolls, croissants for breakfast, and they were embracing, and they were, oh my God, what a relief it was. And I'm telling you, I felt so alive. And I got that, oh boy, I bet my husband would like to meet this one. Instead of the the fraud, the masquerader with the back pains and the all finished, you know, life is over and now we will just walk down the long gray tunnel and be of service when we can. And but I'll tell you something, when you're lying in the bed unable to get out of it, you lose your credibility as a sponsor. They don't quite want what you have. So I had a wonderful time in Paris, and I said, oh, I'm going to go home and just be like this. Just be me. Whatever me is going to be enough. Now, from there, I went to London. And again, I didn't know what happened to me. I didn't know it until in retrospect. But my first day in London, I totally fell apart on the streets of London. I had a language problem. I could not understand the language. It was English. I'd had no trouble in Paris. I was lost. I was totally lost. I got hysterical and started to cross the streets of London. And I didn't know what training in AA. You run to an AA. I really planned to go to London, you know, because I was only going to be there 6 days. But that's my training, as you run to an AA meeting, and there's something happening to me here. So I made a telephone call to one of our members who was there shooting a film, and they told me where a daytime meeting was in London, and I got there, and I held on until they got there and opened the doors, and there was a young man from Laguna Beach leading the meeting, you know, and not he who walks on water. They called the meeting to order, and I immediately raised my hand, and I was hysterical, and I was crying. And I said, I don't know what's happening to me. I said, this doesn't happen to me. I'm sober almost 15 years, and I don't remember this ever happening. I don't fall apart like this. I don't cry and get hysterical, but I don't understand, and I'm terrified, and something's going on, and I don't know what it is. And I just went on and on and on and on. And I didn't plan to be at a meeting, but that's my training, you know, and I said, I go to lots of meetings, and I'm very active, and I had to tell them who I was before I'd let them help me, you understand? And the paradox of the ego and lack of it, of the alcoholic, you know. When I finished, two men, in turn, attempted to talk to me. This is probably the most valuable thing that happened. I felt they were talking down to me. What they were saying to me, what I heard was, well, you have to go to meetings until you want to go to meetings, and then you don't have to go to any meetings because you want to go to meetings. And I thought, oh, bullshit, I know all of that. I know that. I tell people that. That's not what's happening to me, you know? I go to meetings. I say all of that. I say, something else is happening. I'm falling apart. What's going on here? And then the third man was a very soft-spoken man. Reminded me of my friend. And he started to share with me. And I want to tell you that the nature of my sharing changed that day at that meeting. Because he started to share. And what he said is, you know, about 8 years ago when I was 12 years sober, I took a business trip to Germany. He said, you know, things weren't really all that happy at my house. A lot of compromises going on in our marriage. But I was 12 years sober. I can handle it. He said, in my business, he said, I was cutting a few corners here and there. Little less than ethical in my dealings with other people, but I can handle it. I'm 12 years sober. And he proceeded to give examples of my life. He was talking about what was going on in my life. And part of my head, my ego, wanted to reassert itself. And I knew what he was going to say, and I said, no, no. In my head, I was saying, no, you don't understand. I've been sober almost 15 years, and I have never had a drinking thought, ever, in all these years. And the other half of my head said, listen to this man, he has something to say to you. As I kept forcing my mind open. And he said, then one day, someone offered me a drink, and I took it. said, I realized later that drinking didn't count in a foreign country. And I was in one. And the minute he said it, I knew that was absolutely where I was in my life. I knew that I was heading for a drink, that I had been heading for a drink, that that was what was going on in my life. And I was so dishonest with myself, I never ever saw it. So the first thought I had about drinking happened at an AA meeting, thank God. What I had heard about slips in Alcoholics Anonymous was that by the time the thought of a drink actually hits you, it probably is already too late. You've probably already gotten rid of every defense you had against the first drink. You probably stopped going to meetings. You probably found fault with the speakers. You probably decided you disliked this group and that group. You probably decided the book didn't apply to you, that you were a different kind of drinker. It had been described to me like the slippage of a mountain, the underside of a mountain, that it all the support systems go before the first crack shows on the mountain. And probably it's too late. That's what I'd heard for 15 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, a lot. And so it scared me, because I didn't know how far I'd gone, but I definitely knew that's what was going on. I got real scared. I grabbed the young man after the meeting, and I told him that's what was going on. I shared that, and I cried. So I grabbed this young man, and I said, please don't leave me alone. I'm terrified, and I don't want to be alone, and I just need to talk to one of us, you know. I mean, being a member of this fellowship is such a gift, because you can just take somebody's hand and start from right where you are, and they come from the same place, and they know, and you don't have to fill in any of the background. They just know. We walked on the streets of London for about 4 hours, and I took my inventory with that young man, and he with me. He told me about himself. And I told him what had been going on in my life. And I felt safe until it was time to go to a meeting again that night. And I stayed surrounded by AAs and the meetings. I met a girl at a meeting who had a gold 5 around her neck. It was mine. A baby of mine had gone to London 5 years earlier and 12-stepped her and passed on the 5 I'd given her. And it was like, you know, what they told me when I got to AA, we're links in the chain, and it goes on and on and on. So it was like family. And I felt very safe in London with those people. When I came home, I knew that there were some things I was going to have to change in my life for me. Because if not, I was going to drink. And when I came back, I thought I'd be able to do it within the context of my marriage. And I explained to my husband that there were some things I was going to have to do for me, that I had set him up as an ogre and them up as an ogre, you know, and that I was just getting ready to drink, and there were some things I was going to have to do for me. And I thought I could do that. I mean, the truth of the matter is I lasted 8 days in my marriage, and I realized that I wasn't willing to do it. And it just came down to bare essentials. I didn't want to be there. And I had to leave there. So I left a marriage of 15 years and all that support system and everything. And I was scared to death. And what I did about it was I had two people who lived at the beach. I had my first sponsor, the only sponsor I'd had all the way through, Clancy. And I had my friend Eddie at the beach. And I moved to the beach, and I called Clancy, and I said, I'm terrified that I'm going to drink, and I'm willing to do anything you tell me to do, go to any meetings you tell me to go to, just do anything. I've got to stay sober, and I'll do anything. And he guaranteed me again that if I would do what he told me to do, I would not drink. My friend Eddie... It was August, 3 years ago, and we'd meet every morning at 7 o'clock and walk on the beach. We'd walk 3 and 4 miles every day. And what I did was, I cried a lot. I was scared. I didn't know if I'd gone too far. And I cried, and I'd pray, and Eddie would talk and talk and talk. And Eddie would take my face and say, "Don't you know how wonderful you are? Don't you know how beautiful you are? Don't you know how good you are? Don't you know how people love you? Don't you know?" And he just would try to heal me and make me just be okay. Some days he wouldn't walk with me, and I'd walk by myself on the sand, and I'd pray. And I want to share with you what I had to pray over and over and over for those months, because it's the most important prayer that I've ever said, and it applies every day of my life. What I said was, "Please, God, keep me in the now, right now, because now it's all I have, and right now I'm safe. I'm not drinking. I'm on the beach. The ocean is there. Nothing's going to fall on my head. Nothing's going to hurt me. I'm not drinking. I'm safe right now." It's when I get into the past of what almost happened, what I almost did, what could have happened, what I should have changed. Or when I get into the future of, "Oh my God, you're a 44-year-old woman. You're spoiled rotten. You're going to have to go out and support yourself. There's no job market for you out there. What are you going to do? There'll never be anybody else in your life. It is all over. What are you going to do in your future?" When I get into the past or the future, I'm screwed. I'm just totally confused and terrified. But if I stay right now I'm safe. And so I begged and prayed to just be kept in the now. And that's all I had. And the now was enough, because Eddie walked with me and talked with me, and I prayed and I cried and I cried and I prayed for several months. And one day it was all over. One day it just was okay. I was safe. I had become totally enmeshed in my group again. I was actively involved in sponsoring people again. I was just doing out of terror and fear like a newcomer. And one day I realized it was all okay, that I was safe, and I made it. And I didn't drink. Eddie died a couple of months later. And I feel that he lived long enough to save my life. I had to go to work. And, you know, you really... You know, I act two or three times a year, whether I need it or not, and you really can't support yourself very well as an actress. So I knew I needed to do something. I didn't know what it was going to be. And, you know, a lot of people on this program say if you need to go to work, you better get out there and hustle for a job, because if you're walking on the beach, God isn't going to come down to the beach to get you. You sit down and think about it, God will sit down right beside you, you know. Well, the truth about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, since I'm Chicken Little and a slow learner, is my God's always taken care of me and always done it very easily, very simply. Because, in fact, I was walking on the beach. I was walking on the beach with a girlfriend of mine, and she asked me if I'd met this man. Have you met Tom Sewell here in the beach area? And I said, "No." "Why?" She said, "Well, somebody you should know. They have been restoring Venice Beach, and they've been they own a lot of it, and it'd be a good, you know, somebody you should know." I said, "Oh, okay." 1 minute later, he was standing there, and my girlfriend said, "You two should know each other." And he said, "Why?" She said, "Well, because Ginny, you know, needs to do something in her life on a daily basis, and she doesn't know what she's going to do, and blah, blah, blah." Anyway, Tom said, "Well, actually, I need to..." Tom said to me, "What do you want to do? What do you want to do with your life?" And because I had nothing to lose, and because we learned to tell the truth, you know, we just do it by rote, you know. What I said to him is, "Well, what I want to really do is I need a life. I need a life for myself, a career for myself." I said, "What I'd like to do is meet someone who's very creative and inventive and making a lot of money at what they do, who needs help doing it, and I'd like to help them to do it and learn how to do it for me. That's what I'd really..." you know, I don't want to just sit there from 9 to 5. I want to learn something that's going to make me okay for the rest of my life. And Tom said, gee, I could use somebody, but I need somebody with a bookkeeping background. Well, see, I had all that background. I never would have looked for an ad in a paper for a bookkeeper. I would rather die, you know. But the way it happened, the way it happened on the beach is I said, well, let me come in and we'll talk about it, you know. So I went in to talk about it. And as a result of that, I got a whole new career in property management. I manage all the property of these fellas, these two fellas who own a lot of stuff. I did learn it from me. The truth is that this middle-aged woman who was afraid about finances because wasn't going to have somebody taking care of me and I was going to have to work. The truth is that in the last 3 years, I became involved myself and did a little investing myself, and I'm in better shape than I was when I was married. The truth is that, you know, I remember when I was new that something good is often the enemy of the best. We're so afraid of letting go of what we have because we don't know what's around the corner that we stay here locked into something, afraid to turn that corner and find out what's there. The truth is that I'm in better shape in every area of my life than I was before. That it all has worked out. Is Oklahoma close to here? Can I tell them that? I even have to tell you that I took a flyer last month and about 6 weeks ago on some oil wells in Oklahoma. I thought, oh God. And all of a sudden I got a phone call about 4 weeks ago saying, you're so rich I don't believe it, that they hit, you know, the oil wells hit. So the reason I'm sharing that with you is not, well, I'm delighted that the oil wells hit, and I don't even know what that means or what it will mean, you know. But the reason I'm sharing that is I know that there's got to be other people like me who are so afraid of what the future holds, who are afraid of finances, who are afraid of what their life holds. And the thing is, God didn't take us as far to drop us on our heads now. It's all okay. If we just, there is an infinite supply of everything if we just claim it. I found that out here. I was lucky enough to have a few not to be missed, undeniable spiritual experiences in my first years of sobriety. I didn't get white lights like Bill, but, you know, I got instant pain, pain instantly removed when I asked for it, and things like that. And I really do believe that I'm being taken care of. I've been taken care of every minute of my life, and I was the only one who didn't know it. I was the one that blocked it out, that just kept it out. So where it is today is I'm living alone for the first time in my life, you know, really alone. I like living alone. I'm not afraid of the future. When I was new, those first years of sobriety, I used to steal and I used to say it. And I haven't felt it and said it. I didn't feel it and say it for years, and I feel it again, you know. Maybe it's time for me to finish and get off and tell you that again. That everything is fine. That I absolutely know God is running my life. That I'm totally safe. That I'm totally secure in Alcoholics Anonymous. That it has been a marshmallow again. And I'm convinced that the best is yet to be. Thank you very much. Thank you.